So this is the second lecture in the circulatory system. It's called the mammalian circulatory system, a closer look. I'm going to begin with the cardiac cycle. The cardiac cycle is simply one complete sequence of filling and then pumping of the heart. And it's illustrated in my picture to the right. And there's really two main things you need to know. There's the what we call systole, which is the contraction phase of the cycle, and diastole, which is the relaxation phase. Let's make sure we can pronounce those words. Systole.
Systole.
Diastole.
Diastole.
Okay, the duration of the cycle is a little less than a second, 0.8 seconds, and this results, if you do the math, in about an average heart rate of about 70 beats a minute. Now, I want you to think about this for a second. The heart beats for about 75 years, more if you're lucky. And can you think of any human machine which could do something like this 24/7 for 75 years with no maintenance? The heart is truly an amazing thing. And if you look over at the right here, you'll see the cardiac cycle. And you'll see that they've really illustrated three parts to it. Part one happens for 0.4 seconds, which is half the cycle. And it's atrial and ventricular diastole, okay? And it's during this diastole, both the atria and the ventricles are filling full of blood. The second little part here is when the atria actually start to contract. So we call it atrial systole. But when the atria contract, the ventricles are filling, so they're under what we call diastole. They're filling. And that only goes on for 0.1 seconds. And then the last part here, which goes on for 0.3 seconds, is when the ventricles themselves undergo systole. In other words, they contract, and the atria now are filling. They're under diastole. So that's the full cardiac cycle. Well, cardiac output, it depends on two factors, heart rate and stroke volume. The average stroke volume, which is the amount of blood that comes out each beat of the heart, is about 75 milliliters, which is a third of a cup. And this happens every 0.8 seconds. You get the heart ejects about one-third of a cup of blood. And if you do the math on that, the total cardiac output, you know, if you do 70 beats per minute, 75 milliliters per beat, you get 5.25 liters of blood per minute, which if we just round it, you can just think about 5 liters of blood per minute go through the heart. And if you think of a 1-liter drink, the average heart pumps the equivalent of 5 1-liter drinks each minute. Okay, so that's a lot. And this is a really strange coincidence, but it turns out that the average amount of blood in a person is also 5 liters. So essentially, every minute, all the blood has circulated through the body. When you undergo heavy exercise, this can increase up to fivefold. Now, people always want to know, what causes the heart to beat? And the heart doesn't need the brain. Okay, that's interesting. A lot of students don't know that. What it needs is this thing called the sinoatrial node. Can everyone pronounce that for me? Right. And it's also known as the SA node or the pacemaker. These are all the same thing. And just to do a breakdown on the word sinoatrial node, a sinus is a cavity or depression. Atrial refers to being in the atrium. Node is a collection of tissue. So the SA node, or sinoatrial node, is a collection of nervous tissue. And if you look at my illustration on the bottom of the slide here, there's a little depression inside the atria. And in that depression is a collection of nervous tissue. And that nervous tissue will spontaneously give off signals, 70 signals every minute. And those signals will cause the heart to contract. Now, what happens here is the signal will propagate from the right atrium over to the left atrium, and once both atria have been stimulated, then they will contract together. Then what you do is that signal now transmits to another node, which is sort of between the atria and the ventricles, and that's called the atrioventricular node. Can you see that for me? Or the AV node. And once again, it's a collection of nervous tissue, and there's nerves that go down into the ventricle from it. They're called the bundle branches, or bundle of His. His is the guy, I think, that discovered them. And then they continue to go throughout the ventricles, and they're called the Purkinje fibers. Can you say Purkinje fibers? Good. So basically what happens is, if we do the whole cycle, the SA node, or the pacemaker, gives off a signal. That signal transmits itself throughout both atria, and then the atria contract. Then that signal continues to this next node, the AV node, which then distributes the signal throughout the ventricles at what time both ventricles contract together. Yes? Right. They're really replacing that with an electronic device that will give it, 70 little signals per minute. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what causes like an irregular heartbeat?
Lots of things. You'd have to be a cardiologist. They could go on for hours and tell you all the different things that can cause an irregular heartbeat. The one thing that you do want to know, however, is this. If there is not a coordinated, if the heart does not beat in a coordinated fashion where you have the atria contracting first and then the ventricles contracting afterwards, in a real coordinated fashion, then the blood won't flow through the heart properly and won't flow through the blood or the body properly. And what can happen is it's called fibrillation. It's when the heart starts to be spasmodic and it will sort of randomly contract, not in the coordinated fashion. And when it starts fibrillating, then the blood just doesn't flow through the heart, doesn't flow through the body, and death will soon ensue. And that's when you always see, in those medical shows, they'll take out a defibrillator and they, slap those paddles on someone's chest and they go clear, and then they zap them with a whole bunch of, just a big jolt of electricity, because what they're trying to do, it's kind of like rebooting your computer. They just want to sort of wipe out all electrical signals and then let the pacemaker start over again, giving out regular signals. And then things will just go back to normal and the heart will beat properly and blood will flow the way it should. Is there a question? Yeah, it will be external to the heart, but they then place little electrodes in the right atrium, which will then send out that signal, just like the pacemaker does. Okay. Once again, I mentioned that the pacemaker does not need to receive a signal from the brain. It doesn't, in order to beat. It just has its own little thing going on, and it does it from before you're born. In fact, last period, one of my students who knows this said that the heart begins beating at 18 weeks. The fetus begins, a heartbeat begins at 18 weeks. And then from that moment until the day you die, you'll be sending out a rhythmic signal. The pacemaker will be doing that, and all on its own. Now, the brain can moderate, how fast the pace is. It can slow it down or speed it up. But it's all pretty much under autonomic control, which means it's not conscious. So you can't consciously sort of tell your brain to tell your heart, beat faster or beat slower. It's all automatic. Things that can actually cause a change of heart rate would be like a stressful situation. It can cause the pace to increase. And this is what you see these shows and they talk about the use of lie detectors. One of the things they have in a lie detector test is something that detects heart rate. And then when they ask a question, if the person feels stressed, their heart rate may go up. And so if you ask them a question like, where were you the night of the murder? All of a sudden, boom, their heart rate goes up. You go, could be that they're lying. And they have no conscious control over it. So it's kind of a way to get inside their brain. Also, if you're in a dangerous situation, the pace can increase. We call this the fight or flight response. And it's simply a way to help you get out of that bad situation. That's why you know your heart rate goes up, and so you pump more blood to your tissues, and therefore more oxygen. And you know, for instance, if you're you know, as we evolved on the East African savanna, this would get us to be able to run away from a lion or something, or you know, at least maybe get to safety. Also, an attractive member of the opposite sex can cause the pace to increase as well. Completely autonomic. You have no conscious control over that. Yeah.
Back to the last slide. How do artificial hearts
work? Way beyond what we could talk about today. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. We just have to get through this lecture. The next slide talks about blood vessels, and there are five different kinds of blood vessels, and they go... Really, they create a circle. That's why we call it the circulatory system. Get it? Okay. And you can see in my picture here, we've got the heart, and then arteries are the vessels that leave the heart. Then the arteries will break into or divide into smaller vessels called arterioles. Can you all say arterioles? Then the arterioles will divide into even smaller vessels, which are called capillaries. And then capillaries, we have about 100 trillion cells in our body, and every cell needs to get oxygen, nutrients, and so forth. And so capillaries, and the way they do this is through diffusion. So capillaries literally are pretty much can touch just about every cell in the body, virtually. And then the venules are the capillaries will start merging into larger vessels called venules. You want to say venules? And then finally, they will merge into even larger vessels known as veins. And the veins are the vessels that lead back into the heart eventually. Now, a little bit more on vessels. Arteries have the thickest wall of all the vessels. And the reason why is because they experience the greatest pressure because the heart pumps, and that's what produces the pressure, and the arteries are closest to the heart, so they have to be prepared for that. And for that reason, arteries are generally not found near the surface of the skin. All the vessels that are on the surface of your skin are veins because they're very low pressure. Now, why would we not want to have arteries on the surface? Any idea why? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. The pressure is so great that it would just start squirting out of you. And, you know, I was telling my students last period that years ago I was watching MASH. You know, I don't know if any of you, you know, watch that, but it's, you know, a pretty funny show. And they had this scene where there was this guy on the operating table and they accidentally cut into his, I think, carotid artery or something like that. And then every time the heart beat, it was amazing, like, they would show this squirt of blood that went up about 2 or 3 feet. And then, you know, that's during systole. During diastole, when the heart was resting, it would, you know, go away. Then it would squirt out again, and then it would go away. And, you know, I had never really thought about that until that show. And I was like, wow, the heart really does generate a lot of pressure. And so the arteries, the arterial part of your circulatory system, is a very high-pressure system, so you don't want to really cut an artery. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's that? You, I don't know if it was totally accurate, but it was, they were, yeah, no, it would do that if that really happened. It was, it's true to life in the sense that that's what would happen. Yes, absolutely. Okay, capillaries are the thinnest of the vessels because molecules have to be able to diffuse across the membrane, and so all they have is one cell layer thick. It's an endothelial cell layer, and then beneath the endothelial cell is what's called a basement layer, which is some connective tissue. Finally, veins are thicker than capillaries, but thinner than arteries, and because they're a low-pressure system. And the interesting thing, if you look at my picture here, you'll see that veins have valves, and the reason they have valves is it prevents backflow of the blood. Because it's such a low-pressure system, you want to be able to make sure the blood is moving back towards the heart. Now, what's interesting here is, I want you to think about this. In coronary bypass operations, they will often use veins to do the bypass. And, you know, so this year you're bypassing these arteries in your heart, you know, where there might be a blockage or something. So they're using maybe a little vein. If you're the surgeon that's doing that, what do you have to be careful of? Think about it. What do you have to be careful of? Yeah. That's right. You have to be careful that you put it in the right way so that the valves won't block the flow of blood, right? Because they only allow one-way flow of blood. So this is something really critical. This is, of course, why if you're a medical student, you have to take anatomy and physiology in these courses. You got to know all this kind of stuff because you got to realize that arteries and veins are different. Veins have valves. If you're using a vein to replace an artery, you better put it in the right way or you're going to end up with a dead patient. Not good. Okay, blood pressure. Blood pressure is the pressure that the blood exerts against the wall of the vessels, and it's due to the force of the heart contraction, which makes sense. The harder the heart contracts, the greater the pressure. But it also is due to the size of the arterioles, which will provide what we know as peripheral resistance. The arterioles, they're smooth muscles in the wall of the arterioles, and they can relax or tighten, and they can therefore alter the blood pressure. An interesting thing that you might not have thought about, it's kind of cool. Arteries themselves, the outer part of the arteries is made of this sort of elastic material. It's kind of like a balloon, if you think of a balloon. And you imagine, so think about this. When the heart contracts, a big bolus of blood goes into the arteries, and that causes the arteries to expand, just like a balloon, if you blow up a balloon. But then that energy is stored as elastic potential energy in the walls of the artery, so when the heart relaxes, there's still pressure. Do you know what I'm saying? And so then now it's like kind of when you stop blowing in a balloon and you let go, the balloon will go back to its normal shape. Well, that's what's going to happen to the artery. It'll go back to its normal shape, but it will maintain pressure during that time. And so if you look at my picture down here on the right-hand side at the bottom, by the way, this shows the entire circulatory system from arteries to arterioles to capillaries, venules, and veins. And if you look on the bottom, I really like this picture. It shows the blood pressure in millimeters of mercury, and then all the way through the system. And notice at the beginning, like the aorta and the arteries, notice that the blood pressure goes up to 120, then drops down to about 80, up to 120, down to 80. Why does it do that? Why does the blood go up, the pressure go up and down, up and down, up and down? Anybody want to make a guess? What do you think's causing that? It's not too hard. What's that? The beating of the heart. Each time the heart contracts, the pressure goes up to about 120 in your arteries. And then when the heart relaxes, the pressure goes down to 80 during diastole. And then the heart contracts again, it goes back up. Now, if you didn't have this elastic sort of surrounding material, you know, around the artery, then the pressure would maybe go all the way down to zero. It would go shoot up, go all the way down, go up, and that's not good. So the fact that it's in a range of 80 to 120 is because of the elastic material that's basically surrounding the heart. Yeah?
So basically this would take about a minute for like one pump of heart or one pump of blood to go through the artery.
All the way back, yeah. Yeah, it's about a minute, exactly. Okay. And as you can see, the pressure, look at this, the pressure goes down, down, down until you get to the veins. The pressure is very low in the veins compared to in the arteries. That's a really good, this is a nice picture. Okay, how do we measure blood pressure? Well, first of all, let's talk about pulse. Pulse is kind of cool. You guys all know about pulse. Pulse is simply the bulging of arteries with each heartbeat, right? We just talked about this. And it's the way you measure heart rate. And you can actually detect your pulse at several places in your body, the radial artery and the carotid artery. Let me show you how to find the radial artery. Take your index finger and your middle finger and then of one hand, and then if you look at your other hand, see where your thumb meets your arm, right in that area, that's where you can find your radial arteries. So just kind of, and remember, it's underneath a bunch of muscle and stuff. You got to kind of dig around there and try to feel it if you can feel it there. Can you guys feel it? Okay, you could try either side. Sometimes you can feel it better on one side than the other. Also, try your carotid. Your carotid is the one in your neck, and that might be easier because it's closer to your heart, and it's really, you can feel it. So if you ever need to feel your pulse, those are two places to find it. Because most of your arteries are deep underneath your muscles and so forth.
Don't eat that blood.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, but it's because it's further away, right? So there'll be a bit of a delay. Good point. Now, everybody, the next word is the hardest word to pronounce in all of AP Bio. So everyone focus, sphygmomanometer. One more time, sphygmomanometer. So what this thing is, it's an instrument for measuring blood pressure. And you measure it in your upper, you guys, we measure the blood pressure in our arms. And so what the doctor does, here's what they do. They take the blood pressure, the sphygmomanometer, they put the blood pressure cuff around your upper arm, and they pump it up to about 200 millimeters of mercury. So what happens is it'll completely cut off the flow of blood into your arm. So it's like a temporary tourniquet, and that's why it hurts. And then what happens is they've got a stethoscope. This is the old school way of doing it. And they're listening to your artery to see if they can hear anything. And they start releasing the pressure in the cuff. And what happens is, as the pressure in the cuff releases and gets less and less, eventually the pressure exerted by the heart will just overcome the pressure of the cuff, and blood will start to flow through, and you can hear it. And that'll be what we term your systolic pressure. And that's pressure caused by the beating of the heart. Then what they do is they continue to listen. They continue to release the pressure until you reduced all the pressure on the artery, so that now the blood can flow smoothly, and that's the resting heart pressure, which is the diastolic pressure, and it's usually 120 over 80. That's what it is, millimeters of mercury. Yeah?
Wouldn't it be better if it like,
no, because your body, it's like this. Your body is designed for a certain pressure. So it'd be like, you would, like at your home, if you've got pipes in your home, you say, oh, we need more water pressure because that would make the water flow better. No, you'll break the pipes. You don't want to break your pipes. So you need to have the right pressure, not too much, not too little. Okay, yeah.
What's considered?
Well, it depends. You know what I think I'll do is I'll wait and talk about that because we're going to do a lab that deals with blood pressure. So let me wait and talk about that when we get to the lab.
Are we going to use?
Yes, we're going to use this. We are going to use a sphygmomanometer. Okay, let me talk about blood flow in capillaries. At any one time in your body, 5 to 10% of the capillaries have blood flowing through them. That means that you only use blood where you need it. In other words, blood isn't flowing everywhere at once. You can control the flow of blood through several things. You can have smooth muscles surround the arterioles. They can control your blood, the flow into the capillary beds. There are also what are called pre-capillary sphincters, which are smooth muscle that literally control whether blood goes into your capillary beds or not. And you can see that on my picture right here. So, and this is all under autonomic control. You don't have any conscious control over this. Okay, this slide's a little complicated, but I'll try to summarize it briefly. Movement of material in and out of the circulatory system occurs in one place, and that is in the capillary. What happens here is that at the beginning of the capillary, which is on the left of the picture, blood pressure causes 85% of the stuff in the capillary to leave and go out into the tissues, okay? It leaves in two ways, by diffusion. Remember, diffusion is the movement from high concentration to low concentration. Okay, so oxygen is a great example of that. It goes from high concentration to low concentration. And then the other way you move material is through bulk flow. And bulk flow is how you move large things like water, sugar, salts. And you do that by pushing stuff through the clefts between the cells, okay? And that's bulk flow. So most, 85% of the stuff leaves your circulatory system, goes into the tissue. Some material, however, will not leave. Red blood cells don't leave. Large proteins don't leave. And for that reason, they stay in the system. When you get to the other side of the capillary bed, on the other side, osmotic pressure will cause material to return to the capillary. So 85% of the stuff that went out, well, 85% comes back. So basically, there's no net movement when you net it out. It's all, you have the same amount of material flowing into the capillary that you have flowing out of the capillary, but there is movement across the capillaries when you're inside the capillary bed. So that's kind of just a quick summary of what's going on inside the capillary. Let's talk about blood briefly. It's considered a connective tissue, and it's made of two main materials, either what we call plasma or cells. Plasma makes up about 55% of the blood. Cells make up about 45%. So, I mean, if you really want to think, it's like 50-50, basically. 90% of plasma is simply water. All the other stuff in plasma is listed here on the slide. It's a bunch of different ions, a bunch of, proteins, and so on and so forth. So that's what plasma is. Cells, there's two main types of cells found in the body, red blood cells and white blood cells. Now, you need to learn the official technical name. Erythrocytes are the technical name for red blood cells because erythro means red in Greek, and cyte means cell. Let's say that, erythrocytes. Erythrocytes have no nuclei, no mitochondria. They're packed with hemoglobin, and they're basically there to move oxygen around the body. Okay? White blood cells are called leukocytes. Leuko means white. Can you say that for me? Leukocytes. Now, I'm not going to make you memorize these, but I do want you to recognize these. Over here are the five different types of white blood cells. I'm going to say them for you. You don't have to pronounce them. I'll just say them right now. Basophil, eosinophil, lymphocyte, neutrophil, and monocyte. Just recognize them. Don't memorize them. These guys are like your homeland security. It's like the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, the local police. These guys protect you from nasty things that could happen to you. Okay, we'll talk about how that works second semester when we get into the immune system. The last thing that we find in blood are platelets, and they're pieces of cell essentially that are used in clotting. The blood cells, how are they produced? In the next slide, I go into this in kind of detail, but I want to just summarize this for you. First of all blood cells are produced in the bone marrow, and all blood cells come originally from, if you see in my picture, what's called a pluripotent stem cell. That's the originator of all blood cells. And all blood cells differentiate into all their different types from that original stem cell. Now, we read a lot about stem cells in the media. We hear about it in the media. We read about it. I want to just sort of tell you some basic things that you need to know. And depending on who you read, you'll get different stories on this. But this is, to the best of my knowledge, this is how you need to understand it. There's two terms. One term is called pluripotent, and another term is totipotent. And if you have a pluripotent stem cell and you have a totipotent stem cell, they're slightly different. Pluripotent means it's a stem cell that can differentiate into any kind of tissue, any kind of cell. Okay? And the only thing that it can't develop into is it can't develop into a brand new organism, you know, a brand new fetus or a brand new adult animal. All it can do is differentiate into different kinds of tissue. The buzz in the media that you hear about are called embryonic stem cells, and these are the original cells from which any cell can be derived. And these are what we call totipotent. They're totally potent. In other words, they can become a new fetus, you know, and eventually an adult animal. They can become any cell in the animal. They're the, you know, the cell that people are really is concerned about, because then you can do anything with them. But pluripotent are very good too, because you can make any tissue from them. What we're talking about here are pluripotent stem cells specifically for making blood cells, okay? By the way, we'll talk more about this second semester, but I just kind of wanted to give you some background. In terms of blood clotting, you do not need to memorize how blood clotting works. Don't worry about it. What I would like you to appreciate, though, is that blood is a crazy thing, because you think about it, like a blood, let's say you get a hole in one of your vessels. Blood, which is the material that goes through the vessels, actually has all the repair material to plug that hole. It'd be like if you had pipes at home, which you do, and you have water flowing through it, it would be like if you busted a hole in one of your pipes, that the water would somehow have material in it that would then seal that hole in your pipes in your home, that you would never have to fix a pipe with a hole in it. The water would have some material in it that would fix it, which is amazing. So I just want you to appreciate that. The details you do not need to know. You know, you got prothrombin that becomes thrombin and fibrinogen that becomes fibrin. Platelets are involved. You've got all these other clotting factors. Vitamin K is important. There's a lot of stuff going on here. Yeah. Yeah, anytime you ever get any kind of cut, this is what's happening, right? Because you automatically seal all cuts in your cardiovascular system. It's amazing. Okay, this is the depressing part of the lecture. The cardiovascular system is a mission-critical system. If it fails, the organism will die. So aside from cancer, the leading cause of death in the United States are, the leading causes of death are heart attacks and strokes. So I don't mean to be morbid, but if we think about how we are all going to probably die, if we, you know, live a long life, we're probably going to die of one of three things: cancer, heart attack, or stroke. So, you know, it is what it is. Now, let me talk a little bit about this. Atherosclerosis, it's a tongue twister, is the following. It's when the artery walls become infiltrated with connective tissues and lipids, and they form what's called plaque. And this plaque will harden sometimes with calcium. And you can see on the left a really nice artery, nice, smooth, big opening. And then one on the right has got all this plaque. And when that happens, it prevents blood flow. And when you prevent blood flow, if it happens in the heart, arteries that feed the heart, you get a heart attack. If it happens to arteries that feed the brain, you get a stroke. And so this is not a good thing. So you want to watch your diet. You want to find out if you've got the right LDL, HDL, triglycerides, all these different things that the doctor can tell you about. And then if you need to, either change your diet, or you can take drugs that will help this out. These statins are very popular drugs that help reduce the amount of cholesterol in your body and therefore reduce this plaque buildup. Okay? That's it for today.